Hello, everyone. Welcome to the TF Blockchain Podcast, where we interview blockchain and digital currency innovators building our distributed future. I'm your host and founder of TF Blockchain, Jonathan G. Blanco. TF Blockchain hosts premier conferences, events, and media featuring blockchain leaders actively growing the industry. With our platform, we are connecting business and technology executives with blockchain innovators leading the charge. Through our interactive speaker presentations, facilitated networking sessions, and our video and podcast series. Before we get started, wanted to tell you about our consulting arm, TF Agency, where we work with blockchain companies, companies looking to adopt the technology, entrepreneurs and investors looking to understand the space, and with those looking to grow their career in this emerging industry. For more information, please email us at info@tfagency.io. Well, everybody, thank you so much for being here. My name is Jonathan. I'm the founder of TF Products. I'm really excited to introduce John Croy to you all. He's the CEO and co-founder of Point Inside, and I'll let him share a little bit about himself. Thank you for coming.
Great. Glad to be here. Where do you want me to start? Do you want me to start with the birth of Point Inside?
No, let's start with the birth of John Croy. Tell us, how did you get into product management to begin with?
I'm glad you started there.
Yeah.
I've always been an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
I was the kid that had the lemonade stand. I was the kid that was selling knives or Christmas greeting cards or whatever it was, knocking door to door and doing things. Probably because we grew up poor and I just had to figure out a way to, buy a toy. And it turns out that experience really guided my life in terms of the choices I made in a career. I was not used to working for somebody, and I was used to kind of self-directing my work and figuring out where the opportunities.
Entrepreneurial story there,
reside.
Totally.
Yeah.
Cool. So, all right. So you're selling lemonade, and then all of a sudden you're like, I want to get into technology. Take us through that flow.
Well, my dad was a technology guy, and we had a what are those called, acoustic coupler modem, and I was kind of a hacker, playing around with command line stuff, and I figured out how to, using his modem, get access to some warehouse in the middle of who knows where that sold stereo equipment. And I realized
through the modem.
Yeah. Okay. So I realized quickly that I could, click away at the keyboard. This is in 83 or 4. Click away at the keyboard and get UPCs with an inventory number and a price. And then I'd walk down to the local Tech Hi-Fi or something. I don't remember what it was named. The equivalent of Magnolia Hi-Fi in Detroit. And I'm like, wow, look at these speakers. They're $300 each. And the warehouse had them for $120 each. And so I'm going to do a test purchase. And I bought some stuff. And the UPS guy shows up at my door with a couple big speakers in his hands. And he says, that'll be whatever it was, right? And I had to have a money order. And you never knew exactly what the shipping and handling charge was. You never knew exactly what the price was going to be with tax and everything. And so you had to have a money order for approximately the right amount and then a bunch of cash to fill in the blanks. And so that was my first business, was actually.
So I'm curious why you didn't invent Amazon.
me too. Me too. First showroom right here.
Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, that's just like definitely trying to figure out ways to put things together, hack together. Definitely you found a pain point for yourself, at least.
Myself and then all my friends, we'd walk into Magnolia Hi-Fi or whatever it was called.
So what would you do? Just come in and be like, hey, like, this is the price, we want it for this price? Or were you?
No, I would guarantee them half price.
Oh,
so whatever
it.
They want in the store, half price.
Got it. And then you just buy it wholesale.
And then I buy it wholesale. They'd ship it to my house. I'd have to skip class, run home, wait for the UPS guy to show up. And
that's amazing.
Yeah.
I just like sold candy bars and mowed lawns. Awesome. Okay. So that's then. And then you said your father was a technologist. What was he doing?
Well, he was a math teacher by trade, but he was also an entrepreneur and he did a lot of different things. He started a computer store. My dad actually wrote the very first computer golf game.
Oh, awesome.
And he sold it to Tandy Corp, which it was bundled and packaged and sold with what are those things? TRS-80s, the old computers that had, 14K of memory or something.
Crazy.
And so they sold his games on a cassette tape. When you buy a computer, you get a cassette tape with my dad's horse racing game and golf game and some others.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like an episode that would be a Netflix show or something.
Could be. Could be, for sure.
Very cool. So, so you have this inspiration. You're an entrepreneur. Did you go to college?
I did, yeah.
So are you a computer science
engineering
guy?
Started off in electrical and didn't like it at all.
Yeah.
So I ended up with industrial.
Awesome. Yeah. So just building stuff.
Yeah, building stuff.
So industrial engineer, you're like, you're building, what are you building as industrial
engineer? Industrial engineering is more about process.
Got it.
So, you know, back then we called it white collar productivity. Today it's just process reengineering or understanding the systems that are involved in delivering. And it happened to be a really great baseline for software, you know, functional analysis and design, because you have to think through what's the end-to-end process that you're doing.
For sure.
Where do you add value to the system? Where are you not adding value to the system?
Yeah.
And then, so I, you know, my first foray into technology was really as a functional analyst, doing process analysis, designing, you know, that led to the design of systems.
Super interesting. No, this is really interesting to me, because it sounds like kind of through various points of your childhood and then as an adult and going to school, you kind of programmed your brain to look for the gaps, right? Like,
absolutely,
to like find the gaps, find the problems. And so how do you think that prepared you, I guess, towards, you know, starting companies and sort of towards thinking towards product?
What's funny is I'd never even heard of product management as a discipline.
For sure. Yeah.
Until it was like 2003. When did I start at TCS? 2003, something like that. Where I sat down to talk about an industry topic that was interesting to me. And the guy who I'm interviewing with said, oh, you'd make a great product manager. And I didn't even know what that was. So I had him describe it to me. And he's like, well, you're an entrepreneur. You look for opportunities. And that's what a product manager does. And
yeah.
So I'm like, oh, I'll take a product manager role.
Yeah, I think it's Google that says this, that like the when they hire product managers, they like to think they like to hire people that could be a CEO of their own company or basically be an entrepreneur.
Before we get too much farther, am I allowed to swear?
You can do whatever you want.
Okay, just wanted to check.
Yeah.
You said the word that made me have a visceral reaction. And
oh, yeah.
It just might come up in casual conversation.
We can bleep it out, but I don't know how to do the bleep function yet, so it'll just be in there.
All right, just to warn you.
All good. Okay, so take us. Okay, so you graduate college, and are you working for someone else then, or are you doing your own thing?
Yeah, I was really bummed. I had an engineering degree. I didn't want to be an engineer. I didn't like the concept of being an engineer. So I went to work for Anderson Consulting, and I remember sitting at my friend's. Yeah, well, they had a console, a centipede console. I remember the game.
Yeah.
And we were playing centipede with this gal's dad, and I'm waiting for her to show up. And the mom, like, lifts her glasses up and is like, he sounds like an Anderson guy to me. And so it turns out I was complaining about not knowing what I wanted to do and didn't want to be an engineer. And so I went to Anderson Consulting, and I got a really great, you know, I can't look back at any more fortuitous moment in my life to say that's the opportunity that gave me what I have today.
Yeah.
At Anderson, I was able to do stuff that nobody even at Anderson was able to do. I had so many great opportunities, and leading edge projects and things that were just incredible.
And do you think that had to do with your engineering, because of your engineering background, that you had access to work on some innovative things, or was that just right place, right time?
I'm sure lots of elements of luck, right place, right time. You know, the parking spot was available. The project that came up was the right project for me. I was willing to dive in, and work, right? And also, you know, I went to the University of Dayton. Not many people know what Dayton is. It's not a tier two school, even.
Is that Florida or Ohio?
Yeah, it's Ohio.
Okay.
But if it was in Florida, it might be a tier three school for sure. But at Dayton, you know, I came out and I'm starting work with Anderson Consulting, and Anderson was a premier employer at the time. And, you know, my start group, there was Princeton and Harvard and Michigan and these guys with these pedigrees. And I was afraid, like, man, I'm going to really have to work. And I didn't really work much in college. So I kind of had to just dive in and prove myself out. And so I worked pretty hard.
Yeah.
You know, whatever the assignment was, I just figured I'd figure it out.
Yeah, let's pull this into the product side of it, right? So, you know, I always like to say when it comes to product management is it is a lot of hard work, right? Because you're just... you're really trying to figure out the strategy, you're trying to find the gaps, you're trying to find the holes, and then you're also coordinating with everybody on the team and making sure there's alignment across everybody on the team. Do you have any examples of Anderson where you might have done that? And I realize that was before you even realized that you were doing product management, but any kind of examples that come to mind?
Yeah, there's a couple. You know, one of the early projects I was on was a project called the Full Service Network at Time Warner Cable. And it was just this ludicrously funded idea, $500 million in funding from, you know, US West and Time Warner and Microsoft was in it. Everyone who was a big company at the time was in it. And they had all these things they wanted to build. And today it's your cable box, right? But we didn't have video on demand. We didn't have the internet, right, in 1993. We didn't, or browsers in 93. So we had to invent all these different ways to interact with this massive interactive network. And that was really product management, right? It was just all about thinking through the user experience of what does it mean when you have this capability? And so, you know, all these guys would get together, and I'm sitting with the CEO of Quest and the president of Time Warner Cable, and they're talking about all this stuff, and they wanted to print coupons off at the TV. And so I sat down.
Oh, so like the TV would have a printer in it?
Yeah, yeah. And so I sat down and I drew, like, okay, you got the set-top box, you got the printer. And I kind of drew this picture of everything that's required to pull this together. And then I put a bill of materials and a cost next to it. And I said, well, first of all, you're going to have to sell this thing for about $8,000 because you're talking about it. And then you're going to need to sell TV consoles because you're going to need to dramatically change the hardware that's sitting on, you know, somebody's living room. I remember this, the president of Time Warner Cable was like, who drew that picture with the cat? Because I drew a picture of the cat sitting on top of the TV box. and that was really like, you think through like the whole process.
Right.
And that, it turns out that was product management, right?
Yeah,
you're just
totally
thinking through like the whole, all the way from design to delivery. And what the impact is to the end user.
Well, exactly. You know, sounds like you basically created a product out of the wish list of everything they wanted.
Right.
And then they're like, oh, shit.
And we scaled it back a little bit.
Yeah, like, oh, wait, this might not work. Right.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that's an issue that transcends time.
I went from Anderson to starting my own company and funding it by working half time for another company.
Cool.
You know, that was a little ahead of its time.
Yeah.
It was a business card scanning to figure out where your customers are coming from. So we put fish bowls in local businesses, and then we would run the fish bowl, right? And we would take that data in, we'd scan it all, figure out what the reach of your brand was, your restaurant, whatever it was, and tell you where your customers were.
Oh, it's
similar to kind of what we're doing now, which is ironic, but,
yeah.
But you know, technology didn't scale, the operations didn't scale, and sales didn't scale very well. So I spent a couple of years doing that and then decided to get a job that lasted about a year before I went to another startup.
Nice. So, you know, because you're an entrepreneur, product person, you know, one of the things that people say about product management is that a product manager is the CEO of the product. Mm-hmm. Curious what your thoughts are on that. I have my opinions, but curious what you think.
I would say the president of the product.
Yeah.
You certainly have to have a lot of perspective to be a product manager. And I actually got into this argument with my son this weekend around what it means to be a business owner or a CEO, which is different than running a product. And there's a lot of curation that happens for the product manager, which is, you know, you don't have to worry about the HR policies and you don't have to worry about the banks and the lawyers. And there's some things that you participate in, but it's not the full scope, but you have a lot of scope. And if you want to be a CEO, there's probably no better training than to be a product manager.
For sure.
But it's certainly a step in that direction.
For sure. Yeah. The analogy I like to say is not the CEO, but I think of the product manager as the entrepreneur of the product, right?
Yeah.
Like you're just hustling, trying to make it work, trying to figure it out.
You need, as a product manager, you're going to be more successful if you understand in the realm of product management, who's your COO, who helps you get it done, and who's your CFO, who actually understands the mechanics of the profit and loss.
Yeah.
And then the three of you team to figure out how to run it.
Yeah. Let's run through that. Like what would be an example of that? Like in a product setting where, you know, if you're a product manager, or your leading product, who mm-hmm. likely is like kind of your COO type, and then who's like your CFO?
You know, it probably depends on the organization. I mean, there's a lot of different titles that are existing out there. You know, a GPM, a group program manager, is kind of a mini COO, somebody who understands all the nuances of the operation, understands the roles and the people that are behind the scenes making things happen.
Yeah.
And I don't know who the CFO would be in a product management role other than the CFO.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's a general manager or something.
Yeah, sometimes there's like a GM, or maybe there's like more like a business analyst or something, a financial analyst or so forth. Yeah. So let's fast forward to Point Inside. So love to think about and understand, one, how you came up with the concept for Point Inside. Like, what was the problems? What were the pains that were coming about that made you realize that there could be something there?
10 years before starting Point Inside, I was with a company called Locate Networks. And we had, again, I'm old. When we had licensed advanced GPS technology to run on a paging network. Yeah, I'm old. We had got it running. It was working. And we had Kenny, our test engineer, running over to Bellevue Square with a briefcase that was simulating a pager. And he'd be pressing buttons, and the button simulated the pager buttons. And one combination of buttons was, I am here. And it would send out a, what do we call it, a device-initiated location request. So it would send out a response that said, I am here. And we would sit there in the conference room, and we'd wait for Kenny, and he'd be on the phone and be like, okay, I'm standing in front of the gap. And he'd press the button, and the map would show up, and the pin would drop, and it would be a big gray space on the map. And I literally turned to my business partner and founder, co-founder, and said, we're going to need better maps. And when that company went through its dot-bomb trials and tribulations, I actually created a business plan for Point Inside, which was a mapping, indoor mapping company. But there wasn't the distribution at the time. I knew there was value, but there wasn't the ability to get it in the hands of the end user. And so we just kind of gave up on it at the time. But then the iPhone commercial came out. And everyone remembers that first iPhone commercial with the hand holding the phone, and they're searching for pizza in San Francisco. And it's like, holy cow, now there's a big, beautiful device interface, user interface. And guess what? The number one use case that they're featuring is location on a map. And so now maybe it's time to dust off that old idea and enter into the foray of indoor mapping.
We
did. So we just jumped in with 2 feet.
And so why would someone need indoor mapping?
Well, it turns out that more people do things inside than they do outside. You shop inside. You go to movies and entertainment mostly inside. So where commerce happens is 90% of commerce happens inside. We processed in April 200 billion location records, right? We acquired data from multiple different sources, all these different apps that are monitoring locations.
Did you say 200 billion?
200 billion location records we processed in 1 month. And of those records, I don't know the exact numbers. Let's just make one up. 80%, 90%. They're all people moving from point A to point B to point C to point D, right? But what's valuable isn't the fact that I drove on I-5 or spent 6 minutes on Northeast 4th. What's valuable is that I ended up here, or I ended up at the mall, or I ended up at the airport. And when you conduct commerce, that's valuable to other people, right? And so that's why we went inside. It was untapped information, and we knew that would be valuable at some point. Took us a while to figure it out.
Yeah. And how is that? How do you present that to your customer? Like, how do you present that when you're first starting Point Inside, and you're talking to AMC or some movie theater?
Yeah, the first ones we went to were the malls, right? Yeah. And the first thing the mall said was, nobody's going to walk around our mall with a phone in their hand, right?
That's amazing.
Yeah. And this is when, 2009, and so iPhone was about 3% penetrated. And that's true. Not many people were walking around on the phone. But yesterday I sat at the bus stop, 20 people in line, 18 of them, I counted, 18 of them were staring at their phone.
Yeah.
It's the new way to pass time. So,
for sure.
Or the new way to drive, or the new way to walk around the mall.
Yeah. So, okay. So they say no, you still believe like people are going to be looking at their phones. What are some of the pains that these mall tenants and mall owners are experiencing that would necessitate you to continue to move down this path? Why would they need this in 2009 and then similarly now? What are the pains that they're experiencing to make you realize there's a need here?
Yeah, well, let's talk about problems in product management rather than pains at the customer side.
Yeah.
The first problem we encountered from a classical product management standpoint was not understanding our audience. And the buying audience that we decided to go after, because there was all sorts of indicators that said, go after the malls, easier to map, right? Consolidated ownership, easier to sell to. But it turns out the buyers are accountants and lawyers. And guess what accountants and lawyers don't ever do is they don't spend money.
Yeah.
And so we had a mismatch with the sales process from the beginning.
Oh, got it. So like the person writing the check is different than the person that would probably be using this technology.
Yeah, and the people that own the malls are big REITs that all they care about is making sure they've got leases. They don't care if their leaseholders are successful as long as they just stay their lease.
And
that's really all they care about. They don't understand marketing. They don't understand a lot of stuff. And what we were trying to sell was, get more people into your center, get more people into your mall. If you provide an app, if you provide the knowledge that a user can get easily to the product they're seeking or the place they're seeking, then it's going to make a difference in the business. And it does make a difference in the business. We've penciled it out. It makes a difference in the business. But it doesn't make enough to necessarily get them off their checkbook.
Mm-hmm. And then, so who ended up being the customer then? Was it the tenant, not the landlord?
No, sort of. We still stuck with the malls, and we had our app, and we didn't really know how to monetize it, but we had a lot of people using our app in malls. We had a customer, Clear Channel Media, came to us and said, hey, can you do this for airports? So we said, yes, of course. We didn't know if we could or not, but we did. And they created an app for just extending their advertising distribution, because the Clear Channel Media runs advertising in airports, and they wanted an app for airport travelers to say to the Barracuda poster that's on the wall, oh, look, it matches the Barracuda ad when you're walking through the airport. So it gave their ad sales folks a new media channel outlet to sell through. And so that worked pretty good.
So on that, when Clear Channel was talking to you about that, had you identified that as a potential product before that?
Yeah. Airports have an amazing amount of traffic. The top malls in the world have about 30,000 visitors a day, 20,000 visitors a day. Mall of America is about 30. An airport has 30,000 in a day, and there's, SeaTac gets probably 50,000, 35, 45, 50,000 in a day. And so even the smaller trafficked airports have a lot of traffic going through them. That's why they can charge, $90, $100 a square foot for rent compared to a mall where they're 20 or 30 bucks a square foot for rent, because they just get so much traffic. So it was a market we looked at, but it's still the number one problem we had was we still had to get the app in front of people's in people's hands. And even Clear Channel, who invested millions in promoting the app, couldn't get the app to be downloaded. And so we stepped back and said, how do we do that?
And was it a point inside app or was it a Clear Channel app?
It was our SDK inside the Clear Channel Media app. I don't remember what they called it.
Yeah.
The biggest problem is, how do you drive downloads and who has influence over the people that are visiting the store? We came to the conclusion that it's the retailers. The retailers are these massive beasts from a marketing standpoint in driving a brand, and they have, Target has 3,000 people a day going through their stores, and the average grocery store has 1,000 people a day going through their stores, and so it's pretty easy for them to drive adoption or at least downloading an app, and then it's up to them to keep that app relevant and worthwhile for you to use it. But they, if the retailer's willing to invest in that process, then the map becomes really valuable to them, because you can provide context, you can do analytics. There's lots of things to help people find the products they're looking for inside of an app.
Definitely. So your customer, so it sounds like, you're obviously not a consumer play, right? You're like a B2B play.
B2B2C, yeah.
B2B2C. And so, walk us through like the product process on that, like how you think through that, like how you have to keep the end user in mind when you're taking care of like your direct customer and so forth.
Yeah, so it was really about, what's the user trying to do? They're trying to find a product. And it turns out that most, again, a mismatch between the buyer and the seller, but it turns out that most of the people that are building apps for retailers, 5 years ago were in the digital world. They were e-commerce people that happened to say, oh, we need an app, hand it to the digital guy to figure out. And so they would then create a search engine and put a little map up on their app that was basic. Well, it turns out the search engine didn't have any relevance to the store. They have a one store, which is their e-commerce store, but Target has 1,830 stores. And the product mix at those 1,800 stores is different at every store. And so you can't have a search engine that represents one third of the product. So we had to come up with a store specific search engine. And we spent a lot of time and money trying to solve that problem and convince them that if somebody comes in searching for denim and they don't see a denim search result, they're going to go to American Eagle to buy denim, or some other place to buy denim. So you have to have every, the merchants have spent all sorts of time and money saying, this is the product I want to have in my store. This is the demographic I'm going after, the buying audience I'm selling to. And if you're not servicing that customer when they look at your app, then you're missing out. And that alone is worth, yeah, I think we figured out for Target or Lowe's, it was like $300 million a month in terms of lost sales. Lowe's characterized it at $1.4 billion in lost sales. People that walked in their store couldn't find what they were looking for and walked out, even though it was confirmed on the shelf.
Yeah, definitely. I've definitely done that myself because you can never find someone to talk to in any of those stores.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or they just hide from you. At least they do me. I don't know. So, so you build out this product and it integrates in there. And on that lost revenue piece, that's kind of something I want to touch on. So how can you convey, through the product that you've built and the problems that you've been able to identify that you can actually solve for that? How are you able to convey that to your end user?
Usually it was pretty easy. You would just put a sample of, a test app in place.
Okay.
And hand it to test users and see what they would come up with. A lot of times the more sophisticated retailers would understand that that was a problem. They'd already gone through some Six Sigma exercise or some sort of exercise to identify what's causing us to lose sales. And it was, surveys that they would do that said, people just couldn't find it on the shelf.
Got it.
Despite, investing millions in signage and other things in the store.
Yeah, that's crazy. And I'm assuming you're using like some sort of hardware type technology in the stores as well, or?
No, we did all this without any location technology.
Oh, explain that to me.
It was all about helping the user understand where they were and then getting them to where they wanted to be. And you could do things like scan a product and we'll tell you, we'll drop a pin on exactly where you are because we could tell where the products were. And it turns out that IP, that intellectual property for understanding how to take data, in this example, the product catalog, and align it spatially to the real world is pretty valuable. And that's where, kind of as we pivot the business, that's where the opportunity resides.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I had a brick and mortar retail store and I know that pain very well. So I'm curious, is that just like an extra row in the database, right? Like that says like this is in this location, like this product is in this location, basically? I'm sure it's more complex than that.
It's a row, maybe it's a table. But it's the problem is that you've got the plan and then you have the real world implementation of the plan. And that never is the same, right? There's the Target over in Factoria is a rectangle, right? Like almost every Target's a rectangle. But this particular Target has a slice cut off the one corner, right? So it's not really a rectangle anymore. And guess what? The planners in Minnesota thought that that was the electronic section. But this was the electronic section. It was half the size it was supposed to be. So they would always get an extra truckload of electronics gear. And that poor store manager had to figure out how to liquidate that electronics gear because he didn't have the shelves to merchandise it. And so there's all these stories about a post, in the middle of an aisle where the plan is different than the execution. And so you have the plan, then you have the real world execution of it. And then you have just the real world problem of 5,000 people a day moving your products around
to different spots.
So, and it's truly one of those games. I don't know if you remember playing as a kid where you'd slide the tiles around and you'd have to, get it to show a picture, but you had to move the tiles just the right way. So if you get 17 feet of diapers, but you only have 12 feet of space, but you can sell 17 feet of space, you put 17 feet out there and it encroaches on something else. And then that gets moved over here and then that gets moved over there. And so even one small mistake in a store cascades itself into a massive problem when it comes to product location.
Right.
And we had to figure all that out, where it all is.
What's the solve when people do that?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. Ultimately, for the most recent retailer that we worked with, we used a machine learning model to predict where items would reside based on some ground truth, some scanning in the stores. So we were able to scan 30 stores worth of data that was accurate and then predict where other product would lay based on that.
Oh, interesting. So let's move on to kind of product management as an org. And when you think about like how you build the product team for your company. So, you start the company and I'm assuming you're kind of like the sole product person.
Yeah, the entrepreneur is typically the product person, right?
Right, right. And so I love to talk about how you go from entrepreneur being the sole product to then starting to hand that off to someone else. How does that go for you, or how did that go when you did it?
Well, the hardest part was trying to find a product manager who wasn't trying to reinvent the vision.
Right.
In, you know, reverse 5 years, we had a pretty solid vision that we needed to execute on. And the, every product manager we'd bring in was always trying to do something different. And listen, we just got to finish what we started.
Yeah.
You know, for better, for worse, right? That's what, that's where we were. And so we needed, and it's really hard to attract, when you want a product manager, it's really hard to attract somebody who's focused, because product managers tend to be horizontally, horizontal thinkers, not just focused on one box. So we wanted somebody with that mindset, but we didn't want somebody with the whole mindset. And that's hard. That turns out almost impossible to fill. So it takes a lot of time and discipline knowing you need a product manager to allow yourself to do it. And I would say that we didn't do that until probably our 10th year when we hired Darren, in fact. So we'd never had a success.
I know that guy.
Yeah. We've never successfully hired a product manager before. And I think that's because, you know, you had a multiple founders with strong vision and strong product background.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, what's the curse of the founders? You think you can do everything and you can't.
For sure.
So it's part of it's just learning to let go.
So how's Darren doing?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I said, so how?
No, I couldn't be happier.
Awesome.
I still think, though, that if you ask Darren, we're still learning how to use a product manager the right way.
Yeah.
We're not there yet.
Yeah, so no, I mean,
he's probably a little frustrated.
It's fair, right? Like, you've built this from nothing to something real, right? And then handing that off to someone else that's coming in, but making sure it's going off of the vision, but then looking for the new things. It's definitely not easy. What kind of advice do you have for people in the room, people listening, on how, like, what you've learned in this process of how to be able to hand that off, or how to be able to think through that?
I don't know. I would say that, you know, when I took my first real job as a product manager at TCS, I probably spent more time interviewing TCS than I spent interviewing me. I would ask, I need to go talk to this guy. I need to go talk to this guy before I accepted the job. And that was really because I wanted to understand the culture that existed there,
yeah,
to see if they are ready for what I wanted to do. That's what I think would be the lesson, is like, make sure that, you know, if you think you want to be a product manager, really you have to, first of all, most people don't understand what the heck a product manager is. I swore. And so you have a lot of responsibility to define that. And then you have to probably go in and apply that to the place that you're interviewing or the place that you are working at, and say, here is what I see is my role, and then ebb and flow with it, right? There might be a need for more vision. There might be a need for more execution, whatever it is. But I think you need to take some responsibility to define it, and see how it's going to apply with where you are or where you want to be.
Yeah. No, I think that's really interesting to go along with that. You know, I've definitely talked to people before that have wanted me to come in and work on product with them and so forth. And what I always say is, you know, just be prepared that I might disagree with you, right? Or like, just be prepared that I might, you know, come up with something different. And it's not that I'm going to come up with a new idea, but, you know, the role of the product manager is to come in and be very objective, right? And look at the problems, the customer use cases, the vision, and just coordinate that all together and ideally create like some level of consensus. You know, it's a lot of times it happens at startups, definitely has happened at startups I've been a part of, and I've been guilty of it myself, is where the product vision or the product, you know, even like the scope and where we're going is just different in everybody's head. So it's really that product manager's role to, you know, piece that together, right?
Yeah, you know, how to win me over? Ask the question, what's this going to do for revenue, right?
Yeah.
Because every entrepreneur, every startup needs to be laser focused on achieving revenue.
For sure.
Good revenue.
For sure.
Not the wrong revenue.
Yeah. Yeah, not some fancy, cool, new tool that who knows if
right.
it's going to be attached to that. Definitely. Do you find it easier perhaps to work with new graduates that don't necessarily have as much background or experience in the space, but they're kind of trying to make their way into it?
To a degree, yeah. I really enjoy working with somebody who's highly energetic and maybe less domain experienced, just because I think that you can guide them more along what I, you know, the vision I see.
Yeah.
But then you miss out on the challenges, like you said. You know, be prepared to for me to disagree with you, and you know, there's some healthy discussion totally. That needs to happen.
Totally. I always get worried when people agree with everything I say. I'm like, oh shoot,
what am I missing?
Yeah, like I did something to like damage this relationship where you think you have to please me, and now all of a sudden I'm not getting what is the real problem here, right? So there's pluses and minuses.
And I think the problem, it wasn't necessarily the vision that was a problem. I think it was the strategy, right? You know, we had a lot of great ideas from the product managers in the past that we've had come to the table. But really, I think we probably as an executive team failed to lay out what our overall strategy was. And so it's really, if you don't know what that is, it's really hard for a product person to fill the void and align with it. So I think we had a hard time describing it.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely identify with that. I think as a founder, like you're so attached to it and you've been doing so many things for so long. And it's sometimes you get into this mode of like, well, I could explain to you how to do something or I could just do it. But then you do that over and over and over again on top of hiring the product person. It can create some tension, yeah. Right? What do you look for when you're thinking about hiring a product manager, kind of from a resume perspective and background? And then also, what are you looking for as the tangibles, you know, the intangibles like outside of the resume?
Yeah. So great question. I'm a weird person to ask questions to for about interviewing and hiring. I don't like to watch a movie trailer because I don't want to ruin the movie. I don't like to read resumes because I'd rather talk to the person. Implied in that is you need to be able to articulate what you see. One, you have to have done your homework. You need to be able to articulate what you see is the role in the context of what you might think it is, and ask questions around what that role might mean to me as the person interviewing you. So questioning is probably a good one. Research, preparedness. Those are the intangibles, I guess. As a content manager or as a product manager, I'm looking for somebody who's willing to do a lot of work. I don't want somebody who's like me who can stand in front of a whiteboard all day. I want somebody who can actually generate content, right? It's got to be about all of those things that help the organization be more effective.
Yeah, more process-oriented.
Yeah, it's either a process or a piece of sales collateral or some marketing stuff and a functional requirement, right? The content or the product manager is such an important content generation role because you're hearing and you need to understand and you need to translate and communicate. And if you can't generate content, then I think that's a big problem.
You know, how important is product design and UX in the startup phase of a product, right? And then at what point do you really start to think about hiring that first product manager?
Yeah, so understanding the user and the user experience and the user flow is critically important. But there's a lot of companies that over-engineer and over-subscribe to that from a methodology standpoint. We had a really great UI UX guy, fantastic, right, at his job. But he was so slow. And, you know, like 6 months later, we're getting our first personas and we're getting some of the results of his analysis. Like, we're a freaking startup. We got to move faster than AT&T, right? People buy stuff from us because we move faster than their own people. And the moment we stop moving faster than the guys, you know, and this isn't an entrepreneur in a startup world, the moment we stop moving faster than our customers, the moment we get out flanked. So you have to balance the understanding of the end user with rapid movement as well. So, you know, it's critically important, but don't spend too much time on it. You gotta like make a decision. You gotta make an observation, make a decision, move. And there's nothing that says you can't iterate on that, but you've gotta at least move on it quickly. I think the product manager inherently brings some of that to the table because you think in terms of how the user is going to interact with the system. But the final design, the final UI UX design is is often not what I would have envisioned, you know, from a product standpoint. And I think that if the product manager goes too deep into the UI UX, they're not doing everything they should be doing, you know, with respect to their product management job. You know, again, it depends on the role that you're in.
At what point are you thinking about hiring your first product manager at a startup?
Our investors said we should do it right away. We resisted. And I think it's probably a function of the startup and the founders. You know, we were, as founders, there was three of us for the first year, and then one guy had to leave for personal reasons, but we were all product people. And so it didn't make sense for us to hire a product person. We needed developers. We needed people to implement our product. And so I think if you're a technologist, if you're a developer and you've got a great idea, you should probably bring a product manager on right away. Because you really, you know, you can't just develop a technology and put it out there. You need to have somebody who understands the market and the marketing and the user side of it as well. The most sophisticated planogram company in the world, JDA, they probably have 80% market share in the top 100 retailers. We're not actually disrupting the planogram. The planogram is a way to take a bigger problem and make it into smaller parts, right? So you talk about, you know, I'm a retailer, Best Buy, and I've staked out my claim in specialty electronics, and now I need to have a buyer of televisions and a buyer of, you know, receivers and games and mobile phones and computers. And so the planogram is just a way to break that into small component pieces so that I can hand every single person here in this room, you know, I might have 1,000 linear feet of shelf space. And so I'm going to give Darren 15 and Alexa gets 20 and it goes on, right? And so everyone has a little section of the store that we're responsible for. And that's how buying works. And that's how you buy a category. You buy your cough and cold medicine or you buy your whatever it is, right? And then that buyer is responsible for running that section, that planogram as a business. And they say, if I buy this much product, I think I'm gonna have this much profit, sell this much, you know, have this much revenue. What happens is translating that into the floor plan and into the actual store, there's a lot of things that get lost along the way. And so we actually built an app on top of our platform for one of our retailers that helped them figure out what planograms they even had deployed. They didn't know how many instances of Hammers 04 do I have. And even then, they didn't know how many times Hammers was next to wrenches or Hammers were next to nails. And so understanding the bigger picture around layout was interesting. And then we could start doing analysis on when Hammers are next to wrenches, do they make more money than if they're next to nails? And we could start doing some spatial analysis when you take that planogram and apply it to the floor plan, the real world. The other problem is, again, the real world as planned or the real world as executed. And so you had the concept of the buyers mystified, like, how come this stuff's not selling? Well, it turns out they only have half the shelf space allocated. And it's just not even on the shelf. So that's why it's not buying. And so there's all these problems that happen. So we will coexist with planograms, I think, for a long time. Until I think the disruption in the planogram space is going to be AI. And we had, 5 years ago, talked about a software-defined merchandising product at one point where you could predict what the buying habits would be and predict what the assortment needed to be to service your market, right? Whether that be a rural store, an urban store, you know, a higher end demographic from a income standpoint versus lower end. There's absolutely going to be a disruptor where JDA gets the carpet pulled out from under them because it's ripe for it. So any of you product managers out there that, you know the retail space, there's a big opportunity there. Getting it implemented at retail is a bigger problem. But so that's the planogram story. With respect to the experience versus the transaction, I think that's actually more of a supply chain issue than it is a spatial issue or a mapping issue or an inventory issue. I think it's a, you know, I want to go in and I want to, what's the mattress company down the street here? I think they just got bought. Anyway, they sell these like cheap mattresses. They're inexpensive, but they're really popular. They've got like 10,000 reviews, all 5 stars on Amazon, right? But they just started opening. It's an e-commerce company, but they disrupted the mattress world. And there's a lot of them out there now.
Casper,
Casper is one of them. Yeah. This is a different one I'm thinking of. Like, but anyway, it's like a Casper-like store. But it's all you need is the experience of physically touching the product. You don't necessarily want to carry it home with you, especially a mattress, right? But I think there's that experience of going in and seeing the ring, or you know, touching the tie or the shirt, and then walking home and having it actually dropped off at your doorstep when you get home. And even Costco's thinking about this today, which is, you know, the CEO of Costco said it makes no sense that we have 75 trucks backing into our warehouse every day and 7,500 people walking out the front door with all that merchandise. It's like, why don't we just ship it to their house? And what they're trying to do is figure out how to create Costco experience where you go and you buy what you want. It's like the gift registry, right? Or the wedding registry. You walk around and you scan a bunch of stuff and it magically appears at your house. And that's where retail is thinking about. And that's a supply chain disruption. That's not a...
What's funny is I was at Costco the other day and I saw a sign that they put up that said they were delivering to homes. I had to take a picture of it. I was like, holy shit, finally.
Yeah.
I would have been doing that for a whole while now.
Yeah, exactly. Zipcar probably made a ton of money on people that just made Costco runs.
Yeah. So, you know, where do you find the line between a project manager and a product manager? And I'll go one more, and like a program manager, like where do they all fit into what you're thinking and running a startup?
Yeah. So the P's, right? The product manager and the project manager, I think, is just about execution. And certainly a product manager needs to know how to execute so they can do their job as well. But as soon as it becomes a big enough problem where there's, you know, the product manager is getting burdened by execution, you should bring a project manager in to take care of the details there, making sure that people are following up and running the plan. Again, if that presupposes the fact that you need two people, right? A lot of times in a startup, that's one person kind of combined into multiple roles.
Yeah, at a startup, often that product manager is really the project manager and program manager and product.
And it gets back to the, you know, define it. What do you see as the product manager? You know, the product manager can ebb and flow. Are you marketing? Are you strategy? Are you execution? Where do you fall in the realm of product manager? And where do you want to do? Where can you contribute best? And that role, if defined, there's certainly no demarcation that has to exist. You could do both. But I think it depends on the company and the people that are involved. And that's the way I like to create a team, is look at the players and figure out what are they good at, and then build the execution around that, who the people you have. And then from a program standpoint, that's where it gets operational, right? That's where you're repeating it over and over and over again. At least that's how I've always defined the difference between a project and a program.
Sure.
And I think that's just a different mindset. A project manager isn't necessarily a good program manager. And none of those two are necessarily a good product manager, right? But a program manager is almost more of an accountant, right? You have to understand how to do something and make it repeatable, but you're always looking for that opportunity to improve on it. The project manager just has to get it done once. So that's how I see the difference.
You guys have any good resources you'd point product managers to, whether it's books or training courses or experiences that make help someone be a better product manager?
So there's this really great organization called TF Product that I recommend.
Oh God, here comes the slide deck.
Now here's my presentation. No, there's a couple. It's not necessarily like a product podcast, but there's this one podcast called that was from the YC guys that is called How to Build a Startup. And I feel like all the steps that they go with there is very much entrepreneurial, but they definitely can be applied to product. So definitely recommend that. I need to come up with an answer to this because I don't really have
a good
resource.
TF product.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's definitely different classes that you can take on it too. Like I actually teach product management at UW through their continuing education program. Definitely recommend that for folks. It's a good way to create process around how you might be thinking about product. But one of the main things I tell everybody when it comes to product management, it's more than anything, when you learn about it and when you're figuring it out, it's about learning a new way to think. That's really kind of like the best way to put it. You're not necessarily learning like yes, you're learning process and you're learning these things, but you're more than anything learning how to break a problem down and dissect it. I like to give an example. This one time I interviewed this woman and I asked her a bunch of questions about the role and so forth. And she got every single question wrong, every one of them wrong. But what was amazing is the way she formulated and broke down the questions, right? And then like got it back to me. And the way I could tell her, like, to tell that she was processing and thinking about it and then articulating it back to me. I was like, oh, if she just understood this topic, she'd be amazing, right? And so I ended up hiring her because of that. It was like, I didn't care that she got every question wrong. I cared that she could formulate and break down the questions, because that part's hard to teach. The thinking part is hard to teach. The, you know, what something might is or how it might work, that's a lot easier to learn.
I would look to Kickstarter, honestly. In just the variety of things that come out of Kickstarter, and just put yourself in the role of the guy that produced that campaign, and just think of all the stuff that person had to do to get that Kickstarter campaign launched. And it's just mind-boggling that platform exists, one, yeah. And that some of the stuff that comes out of there is just amazing. But there's an amazing amount of work, and maybe even go through it, right, just for fun, just create something, and you don't have to publish it and, you know, actually do it, but going through the Kickstarter process and just the how-to and what they ask you to think about as you're going along that process is a really good real-world experience.
Yeah, I want to piggyback on that. That's something I encourage a lot of people to do, just with different tools in general, for example. So, you know, you're going to have an idea at some point. You're going to want to work on that idea at some point, whether that's at a company as a product manager or independently as an entrepreneur. And so, you know, right now when you might not have an idea is a great time to learn how to use some sort of CMS tool, or to learn how to use like the different, you know, marketing tools and so forth, right? So like Wix is a great example. It's not the best CMS software out there, but it's pretty simple to use, right? And so if you learn how to use it now, when you have your idea, you can just spin up a website in a day. Right. And so learning the different tool sets that would set you up to create little quick iterations and like little quick validating aspects, I think is really important to do before you even have an idea. So that way you can be on top of it when you have it. And I think your Kickstarter idea falls in that same line. Is you might not be ready to do a Kickstarter, but by going through that process, it forces you to learn how to articulate what you're doing and so forth. Go ahead.
Would you say that the product manager is also the person that is, you know, doing the networking, going to conferences, making calls, things like that, evangelizing product?
I would say no for me.
Yeah, I don't know. I've been in both situations where yes and no. You know, at TCS we did a lot of that, and it fell on me as the product guy to do that. But I think it depends on the industry you're in and the product that you're selling, evangelizing. I would say that it should more be somebody with a biz dev or a sales. You know, sales titles are tough because people don't like to be sold to. They like to be educated. So there's, you know, having a salesperson out on the street is difficult in some of those situations. But if you're fancy with your titles, you can probably get away with it. Everyone should be selling anyway. So.
For sure. Yeah. And I guess what I mean, no, is because the question was more around a lot, right? Like should the product manager be doing a lot of conferences or going out to these things? So I think product manager should definitely be going to conferences and speaking to customers 1,000%, right? But at some point, the product manager needs to go back to building the product, right? And so that product manager is really important to have those, you know, initial conversations, or someone sets up the conversations for them. But even having teaching your business development team or the entrepreneur or whoever is doing the selling to ask the right questions. Like, right. You know, so, you know, Darren and I worked together and we had a business development person, and, you know, created basically a sheet for him to ask these specific questions. And I remember there was a little bit of tension when we did that at first. Like, hey, like, I know how to sell. It's like, this has nothing to do with selling. We just need you to ask these questions because this helps validate what we're working on. Like, it doesn't matter what the answer is. We're not looking for a particular answer. We just need to understand how someone thinks here, right? So you can get other people to do the work that a product manager needs, so the product manager can do that in tandem.
We actually just implemented, or are beginning to implement, that process at Point Inside, where we have, you know, a new product we launched, and now we're trying to get its, understand its reception in the marketplace. And all right, here's the 20 things that you could show off or talk about during a call or a demo. What do you think is important to this customer? What did you present, and what was their reaction? And so that just feeds back into product.
For sure. Like a big part of product management that, that, you know, a lot of product managers will talk about is customer validation, right? And I use this a lot, so it gets repetitive if you've heard me talk before. But there's basically a question I like to ask people when I'm talking about this, and this is, do you like ice cream, right? So if I ask everybody in the room, like, do you like ice cream, who would people raise their hands? Raise your hand if you like ice cream. Most people rose their hand if they like, raise their hand that they like ice cream, right? Now I can ask that question a lot different, and I can say, what is your favorite dessert? Does anybody get the difference in that question, right? So if I ask everybody, hey, like, do you like ice cream? And most people raise their hand, and I'm like, cool, I'm gonna start an ice cream company. Or if I ask you, what's your favorite dessert? And, you know, half the hands go down, and now it's like, oh, I like, I don't know, donuts or cake or pie. Like the question has become totally different. So it's knowing how to ask the right questions and not, you know, being like on Law and Order and leading the witness, right? Like, hey, you're leading the witness with what the question that you want to hear. It's really easy to ask questions to receive the answer that you want. And you got to do your best to ask the question in a way that's very open-ended. And you might not even get the answer to the question you asked, and that's okay, because you might find a different problem altogether. Like, ideally what you're doing is you've asked enough questions, and then you're kind of like doing some beautiful mind / Goodwill Hunting stuff on a whiteboard and finding all the commonalities of, you know, what all your interviews said, to find, the problems, right?
Analyzing it.
Exactly.
Be prepared to disagree with me, right? So what you said early on is make sure you're in an environment where you can voice that. You know, a lot of times people are going to hear what they want to hear.
Definitely.
And so you've got to figure out a way to get the data to express itself.
Right. Or it's like, yeah, it's, and then, right, you can be very segmented on the data also, right? You're like, oh, I heard this one part of the conversation. That's what we're going to build this product off of, right? You got to take it all for what it is. All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap up with that. So, John, thank you so much for taking the time to come across the bridge to Seattle. And really appreciate this time that we got to spend with you, learning about Point Inside, your thoughts on product, and kind of how you continue to think about product and what you're evolving. So everybody, please give John a round of applause.
Thank you.
You have the last word. Anything you want to say?
No, we need more product managers, so go forth. Do it.
Yeah. Awesome. Go forth, product. Let's do it. Sounds good. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the TF Blockchain Podcast. We appreciate your support as we continue our mission to connect the broader business and technology community with blockchain innovators. For the most up-to-date information on all things TF Blockchain, please visit tfblock.io. Please like and subscribe to our podcast to be the first to hear from our amazing speakers changing the world through blockchain and crypto. If you're interested in partnering with the TF Blockchain Podcast, please email us at podcast@tfblock.io. Be on the lookout for TF Blockchain chapters coming to your city, and please reach out to us if interested in becoming a chapter director. We hope to see you soon at one of our live events. Thanks for listening, and remember, stay crypto, my friends. The views and opinions expressed at TF Blockchain events and podcasts are solely those of the ones presenting and do not necessarily reflect the position or opinion of TF Blockchain. TF Blockchain is not responsible for the opinions or content of its guests and does not endorse any particular company or currency. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be used to make investment decisions.